Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace.
And I'm Manny.
And this episode, we're going to be talking about a very highly anticipated book that's coming out today, as this is released, November 22nd, and that is Doomsday Clock. I think... I want to say that I first heard about it right around WonderCon, I think, is when they first announced it. Do you remember, Manny, when they announced... Doomsday Clock?
Not sure. No. Couldn't have been. Was it WonderCon?
Yeah, I mean, I know that when they released Rebirth and, you know, the one-shot special... You know, there was a lot of talk that it was you know, a slow burn, and they were going to continue the story from the one shot.
Yeah.
You know, clearly we got, you know, the Batman the Button series. We had some continuation of the story in Batman. We had some continuation of the story in Teen Titans, or rather Titans, because of Wally West, and then the Flash as well. So those were kind of the three titles you kind of paid attention to. And then it was announced Doomsday Clock. Yeah, and I want to say it was WonderCon this year. But I could be wrong about that. But the whole premise behind it is, you know, the tease that we first saw in Rebirth by Geoff Johns, the Rebirth special, of... kind of incorporating the story of the Watchmen and the Watchmen corner of the DC universe, which has always been completely separate, kind of incorporating that into the regular DC universe. So, as I mentioned, Geoff Johns, the writer, the architect of this whole DC Rebirth initiative. And so this is him continuing with that story. And we'll talk a little bit about things he said about the story and what to expect. But written by Geoff Johns. The art is by Gary Frank, and the colors are by Brad Anderson. So, really, a top-of-the-line creative team. And in my opinion, just initial thoughts, is there's going to be a lot to unpack here. And the story seems like a little bit of a slow burn. What are your initial thoughts, Manny?
Yeah, that's the feeling I got, because it really just... It seems like we're still going to need another one, or based on the way this one went, it looks like we're still going to need one or two other issues to really set anything up. So I completely agree with you that it just really feels like they're really going to milk this one. And I mean, I can't blame them, because this is everything they really based Rebirth on. So they're gonna try to get everything out of it, It was really interesting. I found myself a little confused as to where the starting off point was, and I kind of got a little better feel by the end. But trying to figure out the premise of what was going on and where they are as compared to, I guess, where Clark was at the end, and so it was. It was really interesting, and I need to, I guess, read another issue or two to really figure it out.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. So, what's interesting, what Johns has done here, even though, as we said, it's kind of a slow burn, and I agree with you. I think one more issue for me before I'll feel like kind of the first part of the story, the intro of the story, is over, and we get to kind of the main part, because this issue did feel a lot like setup, and it wouldn't surprise me if the next issue feels like setup as well. But that could be limited to about half the issue, because we've kind of seen some characters established, some characters haven't shown up yet, and I could see, John's introducing the rest of the central characters, you know, in the first half of the next issue, and then move on more to establishing some of the setting. But it may be that he goes about it a different way, because there is a little bit of back matter in this book, and there's a lot to unpack and a lot you have to pay attention to. And it could be possible that he uses that back matter to kind of describe and set the time and the setting, and we don't get it explicitly explained in the book itself. But it's going to be really interesting to see how the story unfolds. And also, even though it's only the first of 12 issues, very interesting for me to see how this is going to hold up long term, right? Like,
yeah,
in you know, 5 or 10 years. I was thinking about it just the other day. It's been 11 years, or I'm sorry, it's been over 6 years since the New 52. Is 2011. And so, you know, looking on back on that, how has it been received? I think the criticism has kind of softened at times. But that could be just a lot of the goodwill of what DC has done with Rebirth. That we look back at New 52 now, and it's not as awful as people, you know, were saying at the time. So, you know, clearly Doomsday Clock pulls a lot from Watchmen, you know, one of the greatest selling graphic novels of all time by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. So clearly that's well received. And so it'll be interesting to see how this is perceived and accepted, you know, 30 years from now. Watchmen came out in 86, so we're actually looking at over 30 years. So, and I should say, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, that because Watchmen is so beloved, that there was some backlash.
Oh, yeah.
When DC a few years ago came out, revisited that world and came out with some Before Watchmen miniseries, even though it was a who's who of really great creators, there were some fans that felt like DC had no right to go back to that world, because the agreement was if Watchmen ever went out of print, that all the rights would revert back to Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. And you know, in the ensuing years, you know, and you hear all kinds of crazy stories about Alan Moore, but in the ensuing years, DC had always kept it in print, and so the rights never reverted back. And so there's some hardcore Watchmen fans out there kind of egged on by the fact that Alan Moore will take every opportunity to badmouth DC because they've always kept it in print and the rights never reverted back to him. Alan Moore wasn't happy. He's never happy when DC, you know, makes money off of something he created, and he's not seen a big enough piece of the pie in his opinion. And there's a lot more to it than that. I'm simplifying, but for that same reason, there are people who are very upset that when it became obvious in DC Rebirth that Johns was going to kind of fold the Watchmen universe into the DC universe. It wasn't, you know, completely blatantly obvious, but it was, I mean, we saw that button, that iconic image from Watchmen in the DC Rebirth. If you're a comic fan, you kind of knew what that meant, and especially when you go back and look at the history of the DC universe, which we'll talk about a little bit. But for me, I have mixed feelings. You know, DC has had a long history of a multiverse. And yeah, the Watchmen have always kind of been, that corner of the universe has always kind of been sacrosanct. They've never crossed over with any of the other, you know, worlds of the DC universe, the superhero universes or multiverses. Never crossed it over with any of the other universes they purchased at one time, like the, you know, the Charlton Heroes or the Fawcett Heroes. They've had the Archie imprint under their wing a few times with Impact Comics and Dark Circle and all that. And at no time did they ever, you know, cross over with the Watchmen. So when I first heard about it, you know, I have mixed feelings. I kind of wanted Watchmen to kind of be on its own. I kind of liked the fact that it was always on its own and its own separate thing. But at the same time, I've kind of come around to the thinking that, you know, if it's a good story, I don't necessarily, I just want it to be a good story. You know, I want it to make sense. So how do you feel about that, Manny, about them bringing the Watchmen over into the DCU?
Well, I mean, it was a really nifty way to kind of get out of the predicament that they had put themselves in after, you know, with
New 52.
With New 52 and what they did, especially to like characters like Wally West, and then what they had already done with Superman. And then, I think they really went off track with like, the new Teen Titans. And then they had, just a ton of different things that they were doing that, they were trying to be different. They tried the DCU also, especially after the success of characters like, Harley Quinn. With Dr. Fate, what they tried to do there. And so they recognized that they needed to get back to legacy characters. They needed to get back to just the bread and butter of what fans wanted. And obviously they needed a way to get to it. Somebody, if they're going to blame somebody for it, if they're going to make it all come together, there's not a lot of powerful beings out there that can make that story work. And I mean, to pull out the Watchmen, to pull out Dr. Manhattan, to use him for this, I thought it was an ingenious way of getting out of their predicament to get back to the characters we have now in the Rebirth series. So I really didn't have an issue with it. Plus, I mean, if they're to some DC properties, it's a really cool concept that we haven't seen. So I'm all for it because it's new, it's different, but like you, I want to see a good story. I want it to make sense. I want it to be satisfying at the end because this is, this is it. This is everything that they relaunched with, relaunched with, and now we really get to start to seeing all of those little details that we've been so anxiously waiting for years now.
Yeah, I think one of the things you can say about DC, especially in recent years, is that they've been willing to admit when they're wrong and do things to try to course correct. And as far as pulling the Watchmen corner in, and you're right, I mean, Dr. Manhattan, definitely powerful enough. Plenty of other powerful enough characters that they could have used. That were already in DC, or Johns could have created somebody new. I don't know that it would have had the impact that bringing the Watchmen in has. So I think that is a big factor. And I'll say this: I don't necessarily have a problem with it. Like I said, as long as we get a good story. But the other part of that is even if we do get a good story, what could kind of water it down the road is if we see, you know, they start overusing these Watchmen characters, right? Like, okay, now the Watchmen, you know, Geoff Johns has told a story and the Watchmen, you know, have crossed over with the DC universe proper. And so now they're the new toy in the toy box. And all of a sudden these characters start popping up everywhere. That would, I think, be a mistake. I think in order for this story to have impact long term, it needs to be maybe a one time only thing ever, or at least we don't see another crossover for 10 years, let's say. If we start seeing Dr. Manhattan and Night Owl and Ozymandias pop up everywhere, Rorschach, you know, a fan favorite, pop up everywhere, I think that's gonna dilute the impact and the powerfulness of the story.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. They need to be put back in the box and not used for a long time.
Yep, stick them back on the shelf, put them up in the attic, forget they're there.
And then right when they're just about to have to pay Alan Moore, just bring it back up.
I think that, well, I mean, Watchmen's always going to be in print. And more.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So as long as they keep Watchmen in print, the rights are never going to revert to Alan Moore. So he's kind of a victim of his own success in that way, which is kind of interesting, right? The last thing I'll say about the people who are kind of the naysayers of the story who think that DC and Geoff Johns shouldn't be doing this, and Moore got the short end of the stick. You have to realize when Watchmen came out, Alan Moore at that time, it wasn't like the revered Alan Moore of, you know, the comic world today. He was just the guy that was writing Swamp Thing, you know. And Dave Gibbons was the regular artist on Green Lantern. At the time, it wasn't like these creators were like, oh my god, it's the greatest creative team ever. Watchmen's going to be a huge hit. I can't believe, you know, it's so awesome they brought these two characters. I mean, it wasn't until, you know, a good, you know, three, I mean, it got critical acclaim when it came out, but the reverence for it didn't build until late, you know. It was kind of a gradual build until probably, I don't know, 5 years later or so. It was kind of like everybody was on the same page with the fact that, yeah, this was a seminal work and something that was, you know, very important and looked back on with kind of complete respect. So there's that to consider. But like I said earlier, DC's always been willing to course correct, and in recent years been able to admit when they're wrong. And that's kind of how we got DC Rebirth spinning out of the New 52. And I look at DCU, which Manny mentioned, kind of an attempt to inject some diversity into the line, because there was a lot of talk. It was one of the knocks against the New 52, especially art-wise, that it was very much a house style and the line was kind of homogenized. And so with the success of the creative team of Brendan Fletcher and Cameron Stewart and Babs Tarr on Batgirl, and they had such a unique take. It was so different than everything else across the line at DC. It kind of made the powers that be sit up and take notice. And so, you know, they tried that, but it didn't really catch on. And I think part of it was the fact that it was kind of diversity for diversity's sake. Not to say there weren't some good stories, but it just didn't do what it needed to do, because I think overall most of the books still had that New 52 tone. And I think that the reason that Rebirth has been successful is because with John's encouragement, what a lot of the writers on the titles were able to do is they were able to recapture the tone and the feel of kind of the classic DC universe. So when we look at the story and we look at the fact that it's multiverses of the DC universe crossing over, that's that very much fits into a classic aspect of the DC universe that's really kind of always been unique to the DC universe and what's really driven the charm and the feel of it. And I think that's why this can work, because I think Manny mentioned the word legacy, and that's very much what this story is doing. It's building on the legacy of the DC universe. And, you know, as I said, they've been willing to course correct in the past, so that's what Crisis on Infinite Earth was, right? Like, whether or not you agree with what they did or the success of it, you know, some people think it caused more problems than it solved, which, you know, may have been true based on the way they did it. You know, and Marv Wolfman wanted to start every single thing over with a new number one issue. He wanted to even change the name of DC Comics to Action Comics, the name of the company itself, coming out of the other side of Crisis. Obviously, they didn't do that, and they kind of restarted different characters at different times, and it ended up causing more continuity problems, which then they tried to, you know, fix with Zero Hour and things like that. So they've always been willing to course correct and use the fact that DC has a multiverse as a way to do that, right? And it's oftentimes been with a crisis. So Infinite Crisis, again, you know, following in the footsteps of Crisis on Infinite Earths, with Superboy Prime. You know, when I talked about having characters powerful enough within the DC superhero universe already that, you know, could change time. I mean, that he's one of the ones I was thinking of, Superboy Prime. So, you know, the Infinite Crisis, it was the kind of a response to try to course correct with everyone saying the DC universe had gotten too dark, especially with the Identity Crisis story and everything that went on with that, and exploring themes like rape and, you know, just a darkness. And so, you know, DC willing to admit, you know, kind of a, doing a meta thing and trying to have a story to change the tone and the direction of the universe within the universe itself. That's kind of what New 52 was. They're trying to be responsive and progressive toward things they heard. People who wanted to become comic fans and they'd look at the DC universe and be daunted by this huge amount of history. Hey, let's start everything over with number one and forget what happened in the past so everyone can start fresh. And it turned out they made a mistake in doing that, because they overlooked one of the main aspects that was unique to the DC universe and was part of that charm, and that would be the legacy feel and the relationships. They took those away, and, you know, kind of alienated long-time fans, and new fans coming on weren't exposed to what was so special about the DC universe in the first place, right? So, you know, you had Flashpoint and you had New 52, and then you had DCU as, I'll say, kind of a soft reboot, trying to fix that. Didn't really work. And so then we went with the full DC Rebirth, which did work. And what's interesting is, and it's part of the reason Johns is telling the story he is now with such a powerful character like Dr. Manhattan, is Johns wants everything to count, right? He wants to make sure that readers feel invested, and if there happens to be a particular story from pre-Flashpoint that they like, yeah, that counts. You don't feel like you read it for no reason. If it's a New 52 story and you read it and you liked it, you know, whether it be, you know, Court of Owls or you know, whatever, that if you read it, you feel like it counts, and it's not, you didn't waste your time reading it, right? So I think that's kind of the impetus behind this story. And Johns has said specifically at San Diego Comic-Con this last year that this is, at its heart, this is a Superman story. I think one thing that DC's tried to show, and I think they've done a good job of it in the DC Rebirth, is Superman is kind of central to the universe. You know, Batman might be the bestseller. He might be the one everyone looks to as the A-list, most popular, most well-known hero. But, you know, worldwide, everybody knows who Superman is for the most part. And it's been my opinion that as the Superman titles go, like in popularity and, are they doing well? Are they telling good stories? So goes the DC universe. And, you know, whether that's right or not, it has seemed to play out as true over the last 30 years. You know, when you look at when DC is kind of in its heyday, had its best kind of feel overall and place in the marketplace, it's when the DC, the Superman titles have been doing the best. And they're doing well right now. So it makes sense to me, if you're going to tell a story of this impact and this magnitude, that Superman is at the center of it. And as I said, this is a Doomsday Clock is a Superman story. So he does show up in this issue. Well, Clark Kent does show up in this issue. And where we go from here with him will be really interesting, because Superman is my favorite character. And I think that what they've done with him, what Dan Jurgens has done with him since Rebirth has started, has been spectacular. I fall behind on certain titles from time to time, and then, you know, binge them to catch up. But so the Superman books, Action, and the Superman title are ones I've been caught up on. I have fallen behind on those books less than I've fallen behind on anything else. Never been more than one or two issues behind. And for the last 3 months, I've been reading them, like, you know, as soon as I see the preview copies in my inbox, those are the first titles I'm reading. So how do you feel about Superman? Do you think that makes sense, Manny? And as I ask you that, the other thought that goes through my head is the other giant event going on right now within DC, which is also getting really good critical acclaim, Metal, is completely Batman-centric. So kind of interesting that the two big guns are both going to have big events, universe-shaping events going on at the same time. Interesting.
Well, it makes more sense that you would have to use Superman for an event like this. Superman is one of the most powerful superheroes in any universe. I mean, a lot of people always have that gripe against Superman that he's overpowered, he's too powerful, which I mean in a lot of ways he is. So if there's anyone to threaten somebody like a Dr. Manhattan, or if there's anything that's going to be multiverse threatening, it's going to have to be a Superman story. I mean, how many stories are there where there's a team of heroes and they're doing okay, they're doing fine, but it takes Superman to overcome the obstacle. It's just been done time and time again, but it's just the character he is. You really think about it, Golden Age of comics really started with Superman Action Comics. Batman came later. So I'm not a big Superman fan, maybe a little bit more now than I would before, but I completely understand the reason why it needs to be Superman. It has to be Superman.
You look at the title, Doomsday Clock, probably the biggest comic event in terms of sales and impact kind of overall of media within the last 30 years is probably the death of Superman. Sold like 3 million copies and got coverage on mainstream media and all that kind of stuff, and the villain of that was Doomsday, and here we go right away. You have the feeling that that character may make an appearance in this title based on the Doomsday Clock title itself. And then Clock, a motif that runs throughout Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen. So it's kind of a melding of those two. And I'm very curious to see how and when Doomsday may show up in this title. So let's talk a little bit about the issue itself. But before we do that, I do want to say that we're not going to be breaking this down like panel by panel. I'm sure there are a lot of other podcasts and articles that will, because there is so much symbolism within Watchmen, and it has been analyzed, over the last 30 years, so many times. And, John knows his DC history maybe, better than anyone, maybe with the exception of Mark Waid. But he knows his DC history. He loves to mine it, and there are a lot of little Easter eggs and little things that you notice that enrich the story. And if you listen to a podcast that breaks it down, panel by panel, you may get more out of it yourself. But just in the interest of time and our sanity, Manny and I aren't going to be going that in depth. I think that one of the other podcasts I listened to, a podcaster I know who's been doing it for a long time, one of the first from Comic Geek Speak, Peter Rios, has his Daily Rios podcast. I know he's going to be doing what he calls a breakdown of each issue. So I encourage you to, if you want to get even more in depth into the Doomsday Clock story, I encourage you to go and seek out those breakdown episodes. I did ask Peter when his first episode, his first breakdown was coming, going to come out, and I didn't get a response. I think maybe he's not sure himself yet. It may depend on timing and how many times he needs to read it in order to get everything out of it and things like that. But I'd say if you read it and you want to get more in depth, that's where is. Where I would go. I plan on reading it myself, or listening to it myself, rather, just to get more out of Doomsday Clock. So I think that looking at the issue itself, like I said, there is a lot to unpack here. I think the story is starting a few years after the end of the previous Watchmen story, the Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons story, and it starts out, it's clear it's being narrated by Rorschach, much like Watchmen was. But that doesn't necessarily make sense, because Rorschach didn't survive the Watchmen series. So you're kind of left wondering, what's going on. So the book starts out and very much feels a lot like Watchmen in tone and the way things are set out. And we're getting it's a lot of dialogue, word balloons, exposition, narration from Rorschach, and little snippets of different newscasts just to kind of set the tone and give us an idea of a quick way to get caught up with what's happened over the last, you know, 3 years or 5 years or whatever it's that length of time it's been since Watchmen has ended. And then finally on page 5, splash page with the title, which is That Annihilated Place, we finally sort of get caught up to, okay, now here we are in present day, and we see an image of Rorschach, and immediately you're wondering, wait, how can this be? This is set in the Watchmen universe, and Rorschach is supposed to have not survived. I will say one thing that kind of pulled me out of the story a few times. My one nitpick, the one thing that I didn't think necessarily worked as well as it could have or it should have, is kind of the narration of Rorschach. He kind of has a certain way of speaking, and you know, he showed that in the first Watchmen, but I think more he handled the dialogue a little better. You know, I think that Geoff Johns is just as capable of a storyteller as Alan Moore. You know, everyone may not agree, and that's fine. But I will say that I think Alan Moore's dialogue and his scripting is stronger than Geoff Johns. And so there were certain times, specifically when Rorschach is actually speaking with word balloons, speaking to some of the other characters, it was a little clunky at times and pulled me out of the story. I thought it was a little bit too choppy. And it could be that Johns is doing that on purpose, and when we learn the identity of who Rorschach is, that may make more sense. So, as I said, we see Rorschach, we're in a prison, he's breaking someone out. And I did find out that this person is kind of the Watchmen equivalent of a character that recently showed up in Batman, based on a Charlton character. Punch and Judy were the Charlton characters, and Mime and Marionette, I believe, are the analogs here. So when you look at the Watchmen characters, there are, you know, a lot of analogs, like Night Owl's Batman and Ozymandias is Superman and things like that. So makes sense when you think of it that way. And these two characters, this Mime and this Marionette, are kind of the analogs of the Punch and Judy characters from DC, who really were very, very seldom used once DC acquired them, along with the other Charlton characters back in the mid-80s. So Rorschach goes to bust out one, doesn't necessarily need Mime, just needs Marionette, but they're kind of a package deal. And there is one little hint to the identity of Rorschach. We see, and I will say, I love that it's, once we get to the main part of the story, it's 9 panels a page. Definitely a homage to the original Watchmen. But the one little clue we get, because Marionette is like, wait, what's going on? Rorschach's dead. How can this be? And he goes, well, I'm Rorschach, but not the same guy, different. She's like, different? Prove it. He takes off his glove, and we see that he's an African-American man. So I was thinking about it earlier today, like, so who could this be? Is it somebody that we know, or is it going to be a completely new character? Will he be an analog for another character? I'm not sure. Like, Mr. Terrific immediately popped to mind, and I was trying to think of African-American characters in DCU that it could be. It makes sense. I don't know if Mr. Terrific necessarily makes sense, but I mean, if I have to venture a guess until I hear a better thought, I reserve the right to change my mind, but I guess I'm going to go with Mr. Terrific. I mean, Black Lightning doesn't make sense. Jon Stewart doesn't make sense. I don't know, man. Did you have any thoughts on who it might be?
I'm not sure. Because I was thinking about that, but my first thought that came to mind was, this better be good, because it needs to be this would be quite the surprise, I think, to really weigh on the story a little bit more. But Mr. Terrific is a great guess, just because who would have the ability to go to there. But I mean, there's a lot of variables.
Yeah, we've seen Mr. Terrific kind of dimension hop before through the multiverse.
Yeah.
So that does make sense. But I mean, it could even be that the Mr. Terrific of the Watchmen universe, you know, the analog of Mr. Terrific for the Watchmen universe. Uh-huh. So I don't know. Time will tell. John's definitely narrowed it down by making an African American, that the choices are much more limited. And if it does end up being, you know, the Watchmen universe's version of somebody else, it could be that that version of the character in other multiverses that we are familiar with is not African American. You know, it could just, or it could be a female, you know, it could be Wonder Woman, you know, I mean, who knows how Jeff will play it out. But, the next scene, we go into Mime. Okay, can I tell you that he's my favorite. I loved what he did with Mime. I loved the scene with the weapon. I mean, he's kind of getting attacked by other prisoners, and you know, we learn through the exposition of his partner Marionette that that's just what he does. Likes to build up the drama by acting like he's helpless, and then turns tables. It was really cool when he went with the whole, you know, imaginary weapons thing, and don't you point that imaginary gun at me. That was,
yeah, cool. That was good.
Just really, and the art by Gary Frank. You know, my favorite Gary Frank art ever for me was his run on Hulk. It wasn't quite up to the level of realism and the fine little detail that his art has now. And I think for me, it played a little better on the page. But it's a small quibble, because this art is spectacular. I mean, I love when you first see that close-up of Mime's face. But this art he really managed to capture the feel of the original Watchmen. And I think a lot of that, let's give credit to Brad Anderson, who's doing the colors, because the palette's very similar. It's a bit muted. It's very similar to the original Watchmen. So, once they break out, Rorschach takes them kind of on a journey to meet somebody who's gone underground, and we see that it's Ozymandias himself. So that kind of limits it. That removes him from the fact that Ozymandias could be Rorschach. That was a theory I heard a lot early on when we learned that Rorschach was going to come back. And we get some exposition from Ozymandias about kind of his current state. And if you read some of the back matter, it gives some insight into where Ozymandias is now and why he's where he is. And then all of a sudden, the scene shifts, and we see Clark Kent is sleeping. He's having a dream. It's a flashback to the night that his parents died in a car wreck. And then he wakes up next to Lois, and Lois says, you were yelling, the room was shaking, and Clark tells her, yeah, you know, I had a dream, I was in high school, it was the night Ma and Pa died. She's like, oh, Clark, I'm so sorry, I can't remember the last time you had a nightmare. And she says, Clark says, Superman says, Lois, I don't think I've ever had one. And then the issue ends. So, I don't know if Johns is trying to say that everything we read up to that point in the issue was Superman dreaming, or was it just the scenes of his parents' death, the remembering, was that the nightmare, or is it was it a vision? You know, was he remembering across space and time? And I think obviously time will tell. It was kind of a cliffhanger to end on. But if you continue into the back matter, as I said, you can get a lot out of there. We see a headline of the New York Gazette says The Great Lie. And, you know, you can read some of the stories that are there There's a dossier with more clippings from news articles. And if you read, you know, again, they're not full articles because they're just, you know, little clippings. But you can get quite a bit out of those couple pages. For those not familiar with the Watchmen story, Ozymandias, who, you know, had been one of the greatest heroes and then had retired and become kind of this benevolent corporate CEO, philanthropist kind of person, he orchestrated this attack of aliens from other dimensions to attack the world of the Watchmen, which was on the brink of nuclear war. Again, you know, at the time, mid-80s, very topical, that Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons would kind of tell this story. So what Ozymandias did was he orchestrated this dimensional alien invasion to kind of unite the world against a common enemy, and it worked from what we see. And I should, you know, not to spoil the Watchmen story, but it's been 30 years. And that's how the original Rorschach died, because he found out that Ozymandias was behind all these machinations to bring this invasion about, and was going to tell the world. And Ozymandias knew that he couldn't, in order for his plan to work, he couldn't allow that to happen. And so Dr. Manhattan, knowing that Ozymandias was right, or at least not knowing that it was right, but agreeing with his point of view, you know, basically vaporized the original Rorschach. So we can glean by reading these newspaper clippings that Ozymandias kind of succeeded, and they were able to, you know, repel the alien invasion, even though millions and millions of people in New York died. It did kind of unify the world, and they agreed to nuclear disarmament, and they were down that path. And you know, again, a process taking, you know, many, many, many years. But somehow, what we learned through reading these newspaper clippings, somehow Ozymandias got found out. And everything that he'd hoped to achieve with unifying the world has kind of fallen apart, which is kind of the riots and the feeling that the end is near that we see in the first few pages of the book. That's kind of why the world is in the state that it's in now. You know, on the brink of war once again. You know, people feeling like here it was Ozymandias who orchestrated this invasion. Nobody knew about it, but he was there with his resources to help with the rebuilding, to help orchestrate this nuclear disarmament. And he was just, you know, he again seemed like this heroic figure. Maybe not out there with his fists fighting on the front lines anymore, but certainly a heroic figure who was helping to rebuild and, you know, helping the people that had survived the attack but were left homeless or injured or what have you. And Ozymandias was beloved. And so for it to come out, and from the sense you get in reading the stories, is this is speculation to some extent, and rumor and innuendo, and not 100% established, but he's certainly a person of interest, and he goes into hiding. He's referred to throughout this first issue as the most wanted man alive, and people want answers, right? And so it's an interesting flip on what happened. And again, I think, you know, you pay attention to these little things like the back matter that John's put in here, these newspaper clippings, and it's going to enrich the story. And you kind of get, it gives you a feel of how much time has passed, and it's interesting. So, I mentioned early on, if John's chooses to kind of set the time and the setting for the story, it would probably be in the next issue, or he may continue to do it through little back matter pieces like this, which I think is fine, but it puts a little more onus on the reader to pay attention to things like this. So I don't know if you caught on to that, Manny. I don't know if you got into detail and read, you know, every little thing you could. I mean, it's kind of small on the screen. You even had to zoom in on my digital copies to kind of read it all. But it definitely felt like a richer story by checking out those newspaper clippings.
No, actually, I didn't have time to really sink into those. I was hoping that I was going to get my copies of my books today, but I wasn't able to get them. I'm not going to be able to get them till tomorrow. I was kind of hoping that they'd be a little bit easier to read on in print. So So yeah, I didn't take that time. I did notice that there was a nice advertisement there for Pliers. And it just yeah. went back to Mime's character. I thought that was pretty nifty too.
Anything else you want to mention about the issue?
You know what? It's a great marketing tool to sell original Watchmen books, because just where it picks up and everything we've talked about, and then what you brought up with the backstories, this could definitely put the Watchmen back on the
radar.
More popular title, just because you're gonna I have the Watchmen book. Just by reading this first issue, it makes me want to go back and read it again, just to feel fully caught up again and just up to speed to where they are, what happened with these characters, and now going, you know, be able to go forward. So, that was a great job, because what makes it even better is something that you talked about and that I was gonna bring up too. And when the first few pages, I was like, God damn it. I was like, this is just like a Watchmen book. Cause I remember how much reading you had to do. I mean, it was just age of just dialogue and narration. And the nine panels and the art and everything, it really feels like you can take a Watchmen, then you can take the Watchmen novel, finish it, and then just pick up right here. I thought that was done. Then that was really cool. And at the same time, I was like, well, they're going to sell a lot of trade paperbacks of Watchmen now, because I can see a lot of people going back and looking at that original story, which is really cool.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I doubt that the Watchmen sales have really changed much in the past 10 or 15 years. Probably, you know, it's been a very good seller as a collected graphic novel form, along with Batman the Dark Knight, probably the bestseller for DC. So I don't know that this will move the needle that much, because I think most DC fans have read it by now. But at the same time, there's always new readers coming on, so it is possible that there is an uptick. Don't necessarily think that this had anything to do. In fact, I would be 100% sure this had nothing to do with John's picking the Watchmen universe to fold in. It's like, how can we get Watchmen sales numbers up? Let me tell a story that incorporates Watchmen in the DCU. I'm sure that thought never crossed his mind.
It's gonna work that way.
Yeah, it's entirely possible that it does. This may get the last three or four stragglers, the last three or four DC comic readers who haven't read Watchmen yet to finally read it. You're right, 100%. Based on what we saw in this issue, though, we've been talking a lot about John's folding the Watchmen characters and Watchmen Corner of the DC Universe into the DC superhero universe. But actually, you know, sitting here thinking about it and going over the progression of the story, what it really looks like from the first issue is that it's actually going to be the other way around, right? It's going to be Superman incorporated into the Watchmen universe. So it'll be interesting to see the way that plays out one way or another. So,
you know, it's going to come down to a couple of things, which is, number one, who the heck is Rorschach? And number two, how do they blend the two together? You know, hopefully it's not something dumb, which I doubt. I'm not saying it is, because by no means am I questioning Jeff Johns' writing. I'm just saying that with how long we've waited for this and the meaning of it all, with Rebirth and everything, my expectations of it are so high that I don't want to be let down.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a meaningful story. It's going to have a huge impact on the DC universe going forward. Obviously, because we spent an hour talking about it, and we did in fact say that we weren't going to go that in depth in the actual story itself and panel by panel, and we didn't, but yet we've still managed to talk about it for an hour. So, that being said, I think it's time to wrap it up. Just a little hint on things to come. We Manny and I did talk about perhaps talking about another couple of very impactful books that came out recently, namely The Batman Who Laughs and Batman Lost, which are the latest two issues of that metal crossover that I mentioned earlier. But based on the fact that this is already an hour, and I think Manny and I both want to go back and read Batman Who Laughs and Batman Lost one more time before we kind of tackle them, I think we're going to save those for next time. So I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. Please visit us at the Comic Source blog for past episodes of the podcast. You can also watch episodes of our YouTube channel there. Our famous sketch gallery is there as well. We are going to be migrating the site over to LRM online, but you'll still be able to find it by typing thecomicsourceblog.com, so don't worry about that. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date with new episodes and convention coverage. And don't forget about that exclusive partnership that we have with LRM Online and our podcast over there, The Nine Panel Grid. You can go to lrmonline.com to enjoy new episodes just about every Tuesday on a variety of topics, and those episodes tend to skew more toward beginning readers. So if you have discovered this podcast through Doomsday Clock and you're new to it and new to comics reading and you want recommendations and more of kind of a beginner's feel, I definitely encourage you to go and check out the Nine Panel Grid episodes that are there already at LRM Online, and Nine Panel Grid episodes to come. So thanks for joining us, everybody. Go out and pick up Doomsday Clock. I don't think you'll be disappointed. So thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.